From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what to know for tomorrow's midterm election.
Michigan law does not require a voter to have a photo ID in order to vote.
It will be the first time, I think, in 127 years that straight party voting has not been on the ballot.
John U. Bacon on the successful weekend for Michigan and Michigan State.
Man, nobody gets more out of less than Mark D'Antonio. And I know Michigan fans don't like him any more than State fans like Jim Harbaugh, but I got bad news for both of you. They can both coach.
And he got his start in improv in Michigan. Now Mark Evan Jackson is getting laughs on NBC's The Good Place.
This show deals with fairly deep and complicated aspects of ethical and moral philosophy, and also fart jokes.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, this is zero hour for Michigan election officials. People are coming in today casting their absentee ballots. And of course, tomorrow, the midterm elections at the precincts. The ACLU of Michigan has sent a letter to clerks across the state reminding them of what voters do and do not need in order to vote. Sharon Delente is with the Michigan ACLU. Sharon, you wrote that letter to the clerks because of some problems that voters encountered at the polls. Like, what kind of problems?
Well, we see two primary problems. Number one, we sometimes see that clerks have information posted either in their main offices or in the polling locations that gives the impression that a voter must have photo ID to vote. That is not Michigan law. Michigan law does not require a voter to have a photo ID in order to vote. They can sign a simple form called an affidavit, and then they're given a normal ballot. The second place that we sometimes see that kind of misinformation is in the polling location. Sometimes that could be, again, a sign, or sometimes, unfortunately, it could be an election official who's working the polls who doesn't understand the law fully, and they occasionally improperly tell the voter that they are required to provide photo ID and sometimes turn them away, sadly.
Okay.
So we wanted to get ahead of that and make sure that clerks were reminded and were posting all the proper information and training their employees about the proper requirements in Michigan.
So just thinking about this over this weekend, on Saturday morning, I went to my local clerk to file an absentee ballot. And she did say, do you have a driver's license, which I offered. So it's okay that she asked, but what should have happened if I did not have a license?
That's a great question. So yes, election officials will ask you, and I encourage all voters in the state of Michigan that if you have a driver's license or a personal identification card, go ahead and bring it with you. Don't hold back. Bring it with you. As you may have seen, as voters realize, if they do have the ID, they can sometimes swipe it through their scanner, and it just makes the process move a little more quickly. But election officials, both in the clerk's office and in the polls, must know and must offer to a voter who does not have an ID a simple form that they can sign saying they don't have it or they don't have it with them, and then they're able to vote a regular ballot.
Now, there are a couple of other questions that I know hang out there as we try to bust misconceptions or misinformation about what is required or not when someone votes. So we know that you do not have to have photo ID, although it helps streamline things if you do. What about someone who's been convicted of a crime?
Yeah, so that is another important question. It's a second myth on my list. Returning citizens can vote in Michigan. The only individuals who cannot vote are individuals who are currently serving a sentence in jail or prison. But any individual who has returned to the community, no matter how long or how recent, and is no longer serving a sentence, if they are registered, they are absolutely able to cast a ballot.
What else is on your list, Sharon?
The third myth is that you can be turned away. In the state of Michigan, no voter should be turned away from a polling location. If you, as a voter, are unable to be found on the voter registration list, but you swear and affirm and sign a simple form that you did register in time, you have a right to a provisional ballot. So nobody should be turned away and just sent home. If, on the other hand, your election officials say, hey, you're not registered here, you're registered at the school down the street, that's a good idea to go ahead and go to that proper location that you know you are registered. But if they say, just, you know, I'm sorry, I can't help you today, and send you on your way, voters should be empowered to ask for a provisional ballot. The final thing is the idea it's a myth that voters can't get help or assistance with a voting challenge. We have hotlines that are available and open right now, and voters can know that they can call them and talk to a trained attorney who understands all the complexities of Michigan election law. They can call 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 1-866-687-8683. And as they like to say, operators are standing by.
So finally, if someone gets to the polls and is told you can't vote, what should they do at once?
They should ask the election official who's running the polls, ask them to call the local clerk and look for their registration. Sometimes the local clerk in the main city or office is able to find it. But again, in the worst case scenario, if they're given no other options, and they're not being told that they vote up the street, they should ask for a provisional ballot and be able to cast their vote on Election Day.
Sharon Delente, Michigan ACLU. Sharon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Election Day, Michigan voters will see candidates on the ballot from the national political party that really no longer exists. The Natural Law Party dissolved as a political organization more than a dozen years ago. Yet, as Quinn Kleinfelter reports, Natural Law Party candidates are still running for office this election cycle, but only in Michigan.
I was looking for the physical letter from Gerald Ford, but I don't remember which file I quite put it in.
The only Natural Law Party candidate for the U.S. Senate in the nation rummages through a small metal filing cabinet in his kitchen, across from stacks of books on topics like the collapse of the Soviet Union and U.S. electoral reform. But John Howard Wilhelm has no illusions about his chances in Michigan's upcoming general election.
It clearly would be an incredible accident if I were to win.
Wilhelm persistently emailed with the chair of Michigan's Natural Law Party about his views on third-party candidacies. This year, after deciding he could best make his voice heard as a candidate, he made his pitch to the state chair. One visit to vet him from the party's gubernatorial nominee, and Wilhelm was in.
It's unusual because almost in any other state you couldn't do something like it. It's very hard to get on the ballot to run for the Senate. Actually, in Michigan, because of the Natural Law Party, it isn't and it wasn't difficult. And I pursued it because I just wanted to see if I could stir up things. And they do need to be stirred up because I think we're in a desperate situation in terms of our political system. And you're not going to get reform out of either the Republicans or the Democrats. It has to come from the outside.
The Natural Law Party was founded to take a new approach to politics based on the principles of transcendental meditation as designed by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Yes, that Maharishi, the one who tutored the Beatles. The publisher of Ballot Access News, election expert Richard Winger, says the Natural Law Party was a very different kind of political organization.
The way it was formed was very unusual. It was formed instantaneously all over the world. I think there were about 70 countries that had a Natural Law Party, and they were all started in 1992 because the leader of the Transcendental Meditation Movement decided he wanted his followers to start a party.
Former Beatle George Harrison played a benefit concert for the party, and the Beach Boys helped raise funds for it. The party seemed to be taking off. Winger says Natural Law ran over 50 candidates in a single election year in California, a record, he estimates, for a third party. And it attracted celebrity candidates, like the late Canadian magician Doug Henning, who ran for office unsuccessfully in both his native country and in the United Kingdom, where British law permits candidates from Commonwealth nations.
Now, a party election broadcast by the Natural Law Party.
Hello, everyone. I'm an expert in making things disappear. My Natural Law Party will make the problems of the nation disappear, as darkness disappears with the onset of light. Stress, strain, and problems in national life will be eliminated.
The party eventually ran its own U.S. presidential ticket in 2000, but barely made a whimper in the election. The Maharishi withdrew his support, membership dwindled, financial problems mounted, and the National Party in the U.S. disbanded in 2004. A few state chapters carried on, some merging with other parties, But by this election cycle, a database of all 2018 electoral ballots in the U.S. compiled by the National Institute on Money and Politics reveals Natural Law Party candidates are only running for state and federal office on the Michigan ballot. Election expert Richard Winger says Michigan's arcane regulations made it harder to get on the ballot than in most states, but easier to stay on once a party has gained access.
Well, in the United States, ballot access is totally controlled by state law. There are no federal laws about ballot access. That's pretty unusual in the world. We're one of only two countries in which the ballot access laws for the national elections are not written by the national government. The other is Switzerland. So it doesn't really make any difference if the Natural Law Party nationally dissolved itself, as long as the state chair of the Natural Law Party of Michigan wants to keep the party going.
And attorney Doug Dern, chair of Michigan's Natural Law Party, says he definitely wants to keep the party on the state ballot. Dern, who is a candidate himself for Michigan's Supreme Court, says retaining ballot access, even without the backing of a national organization, has allowed the party to become a kind of refuge to those whose political views stray from the mainstream.
What I've done as state party chair is opened it up to an open forum for anybody who wants to run other than Democrat or Republican. You know, my belief is that right wing, left wing, two wings, same bird. You don't really have a choice. We still try to, you know, educate people on the concepts of the Natural Law Party, of scientific solutions to government. But by the same token, if you've got different ideas, we won't keep you out.
Dern notes that Ralph Nader, for one, used the Natural Law Party to make his 2008 presidential bid in Michigan. Dern says having that access is vital for a democracy to fully function.
People say, oh, I would never vote for a third party. That wastes my vote. Well, with that mentality, it will waste your vote. I mean, if we start voting third parties and take some of the power away from the Democrats and the Republicans, we could really change the world.
For U.S. Senate candidate John Howard Wilhelm, changing some perceptions would be enough. His campaign has consisted mainly of passing out brochures at a farmer's market, answering candidate surveys for a few newspapers, and crafting a website with his policy positions.
Why not? If you don't try, you don't accomplish anything. If you do try, you're likely not to accomplish in many cases anything, but once in a while you can.
And Wilhelm says if he or the Natural Law Party can make an impact on voters with a chance to make more inroads in the future, then in a way, the election is already won. For now. I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
Coming up, what NBC's The Good Place and Michigan have in common.
If there's a connection to Michigan that's cosmic, I'm not sure what it is, but it does seem as though there is some connective tissue.
Stay with us. That's ahead. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time to break down the weekend sports with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And the Michigan Revenge Tour rolls on. It's with that 42-7 win over Penn State. What did we learn from this game?
Everything. This team is on all cylinders right now. The defense has been good throughout the season. It's the number one defense in the country out of 130 teams. That says something right there. Yeah. They've been so good for so long, they've allowed the offense to grow up, given them time to improve themselves. And now the offense is pretty doggone good as well.
Who gets the biggest share of credit for the way things are going right now? Player-wise, coach-wise, whatever.
It sounds totally corny, but right now it's everybody because that's how well they're playing on offense and defense, special teams even. The coaching staff, Jim Harbaugh made a couple crucial changes in the offseason. One, Ed Warner on the offensive line. He is arguably the best offensive line coach in the country. These guys get no credit. These guys are the heavy lifters of the program, the guys in the mailroom, if you will, et cetera. Yeah. But if these guys don't do their job, the quarterback, the tailback, nothing else is going to work. And these guys were maligned last year, the weakest part of the team. Now it's become one of the stronger parts of the team. So hats off to those guys for sure.
So next weekend, Michigan heads to Rutgers. Safe to say the Scarlet Knights are the weakest team in the Big Ten. And I dug up the fact.
And built to stay that way.
In fact, the last time Michigan went to Rutgers, the final score was 78-0. And then Indiana and then Ohio State, November 24th. So you put all that together. What do you think of Michigan's chances of getting to the CFP?
That's the college football playoff, of course. Right now, they're about the only team in the Big Ten who could get there. I don't think Ohio State can get there anymore. I think their odds are better than average, better than 50-50. There's no way they lose to Rutgers. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's a weak high school team right now. It's not good. Indiana's a trap game. They always play Michigan tough. Watch out for that one. And the Buckeyes are having their problems down at Ohio State, but they're still the Ohio State. So then you get to the West Side. You got to play the West Side in the Big Ten title game. Right now, believe it or not, that looks like Northwestern.
Yeah, they're having a great year.
They are having a great year.
All right, let's go over to Michigan State. The Walking Wounded still managed win 24-3 over Maryland. Certainly the Terrapins distracted by the drama over their fired coach, which we're going to touch on in a moment. What did D'Antonio Spartans do right to overcome those injuries?
Man, nobody gets more out of less than Mark D'Antonio. And I know Michigan fans don't like him any more than state fans like Jim Harbaugh, but I got bad news for both of you. They can both coach big time. Michigan right now has been very lucky with almost no important injuries. And Michigan State has been very unlucky on the same front.
With a lot of injuries.
With a lot of injuries. You got backups at a lot of positions, including quarterback. And they're playing very strong football. They've qualified for a bowl game. They'll get a better one.
They'll get a better one. Now, a lot of armchair coaches on social media were wondering why Rocky Lombardi didn't start instead of injured Brian Lewerke. He started Lewerke. Given what we saw Saturday, who do you think will lead MSU this Saturday against Ohio State?
I don't know, because I thought that Rocky Lombardi should have started this game. I'm with the armchair quarterbacks. I think they're right. Lewerke came in far from 100%, as he was also against Michigan. 11 for 20, not a good outing by any means, and he looked pretty banged up. And Rocky Lombardi, all-time all-star name,
yeah,
with the blonde flowing locks. Put him on the poster now. He's looking pretty good. I think you have to go to him.
What do you expect Saturday against Ohio State?
On paper, they should have no chance, but they often beat Ohio State when they're supposed to have no chance. I've seen this before, and I'd be surprised if they don't play him tough.
Over to the mess in Maryland. Will you count the ways the university mishandled the heatstroke death of 19-year-old offensive lineman Jordan McNair?
Sad, tragic, stupid, all at once. Jordan McNair, one of their linemen, 19-year-old kid, heat exhaustion due to working too hard in practice. He collapses, goes through seizures on the field in May, this is. And he is on the field for 1 hour before anybody thinks to call 911. That is criminal negligence. That is horrible. Then after that happens, nothing happens internally. No suspensions, no investigations until ESPN 2 months later, comes out with a searing expose of this bullying culture, endangering their health, all kinds of crazy stuff. Then finally, Maryland takes some action, an 80-day investigation, which pretty much confirms the ESPN investigation. So the Board of Regents at Maryland decide, you know what, let's keep him. The head coach, that is. Are you kidding me? I know the guy, DJ Durkin, nice guy. He was here at Michigan. I like him. Some players at Michigan liked him, some didn't, but no one thought he was unsafe. But clearly his coaches at Maryland were. And then what do? They turn around 24 hours later due to the backlash, and the president says, whoops, just kidding, he is fired.
And the president, who was going to retire at the end of the year, so he bucked the board.
He's going to retire in protest over the Board of Regents reinstating the coach in the first place.
So what lessons should every single school administration and Board of Regents, Board of Trustees, take from what happened at Maryland?
Do the right thing, which sounds really simple. And it is simple, and it's very hard, because they didn't do it five different ways. Do the right thing. Put the players first. That is obvious.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Ubakin. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Actor Mark Evan Jackson is known for playing serious, often stern characters on some of TV's funniest comedies, like Sean, the all-knowing judge of the afterlife on NBC's The Good Place.
Thank you for these testimonials. A ruling has been reached. Oh, you want to hear it. I forgot how needy humans are.
But before he made it big in L.A., Jackson got his comedy upbringing right here in Michigan. Michigan Radio's April Van Buren talked to Mark Evan Jackson about how his roots here have influenced his career.
Well, first of all, Mark Evan Jackson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Yes.
So you have worked on a lot of very funny shows. You've been on Reno 911, Parks and Rec, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and right now you play the character of Sean on one of my favorite TV shows, which is NBC's The Good Place. And you've called this show the smartest, dumbest show on television. And I'm wondering, for people who haven't seen the show, explain a little bit what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is that The Good Place on NBC, Thursdays, 8:30, 7:30 Central, is that within an episode of the show, within the body of the show, within single lines of dialogue, this show deals with
fairly deep and complicated aspects of ethical and moral philosophy, and also fart jokes. I meet people in airports and restaurants from all over the map, age-wise, demographic-wise. Everyone can find something in the show because it's so silly, and yet it's so smart.
And so you were born in Buffalo, New York, so you're not a native Michigander, but you moved here to attend Calvin College in Grand Rapids, and you actually graduated with a degree in philosophy. How did you make the leap from philosophy to comedy?
That leap happened very gradually and through a series of, honestly, very happy accidents. I had no intention of becoming an actor. I did a play in high school, and I did some things. I did a lot of music growing up. I had no intention of becoming an actor, really. And it was just by exploring things and saying a lot of yes. The day after I graduated from Calvin, I was a deckhand on the schooner Malabar in Traverse City, Michigan, in Lake Michigan. The year after that, I was the first mate of the schooner Mercantile in Camden, Maine. I came back to Grand Rapids and ran a fancy restaurant. I was the assistant manager at Gibson's on Lake Drive in Grand Rapids. After that, I went to work for On the Town magazine, selling and designing advertising, and then got a job in public radio. And it was all through just saying yes to things and exploring opportunities that I was asked to become the accompanist for an alumni improv company from students at Calvin called River City Improv. And I was truly at that first rehearsal of River City Improv to play the piano and had this giant epiphany moment and thought, oh man, we have to find somebody else to come and play the piano because I want to do what those guys are doing for the rest of my time on the planet. They were the cleverest and smartest and most collaborative and funniest people in the world. And that's how that was my in. So I started improvising with them. And then when I was working for a national public radio affiliate in West Michigan, WGVU, the touring company of the Second City Detroit came through town and I had them on my morning show that I was producing at the time. And I told their producer, if you ever hold auditions, please let me know. And he did.
So after River City Improv, you head to Detroit. You joined Second City there. You know, Detroit doesn't have a Second City anymore, but I'm wondering, what was the comedy scene like in Detroit at that time? Because you do have a lot of comedians coming out of the city.
For sure. The Second City in Detroit in the, you know, sort of early to mid-90s and then lasting into the 2000s was the birthplace of a lot of great and scrappy comedians. A lot of the people that were there at that time have gone on to success in television and film. And people often ask us what was in the drinking water in Detroit in the late 90s, because our hit rate, our success rate is pretty decent ratio. And what it was is that the Second City in Toronto and the Second City in Chicago, those cities both have tourist bases. People go to those cities on purpose for fun. That wasn't the case in Detroit in the late 90s. So in Toronto and Chicago, the Second City can write a new review, write a new show, and have it up for a year. In Detroit, we would write a new review, and it would be well attended for a month and a half, 2 months, and then our audiences would peter out because everybody in the metro area that wanted to see the show had seen the show, and there was not the tourist base to come and see these reviews. So we would write 2 and 3 and 4 shows a year and got good at it. It was sort of a Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, just doing it, getting more reps, more time on task. And I really think that that taught each of us to be creative and to be prolific, to never let the kernel of an idea go, to file it away somewhere and say, it may not be right for this scene or for this show, but I'm going to use it somewhere. And it made us scrappy. It made us really, you know, sort of hungry and prolific writers and creators.
And I know that you actually have some other Second City Detroit alums in LA, and you guys get together and perform still. Why are you still so connected to that Detroit group?
Because Detroit was an island in the late 90s, all we had was each other. So the Detroit improv and comedy community is really tight. And these are people that, you know, it felt like we went through boot camp or graduate school in comedy and life together. Detroit was a different place than it is now in 1997. So we really hung out together. And these are people for whom you'd walk into fire. These are people that will be lifelong friends. Improvisation breeds that brand of friendship to begin with. It sort of deconstructs you and you do this together. So you're being vulnerable in front of other people. And I think that those who are able to allow themselves to be that vulnerable make lifelong friends. And so, yes, we have a company out here, in fact, named the 313. We've named ourselves after the area code of the city of Detroit. And we still get together and improvise. And it's people that were in Detroit in the late 90s.
In addition to just having improv alum from Second City Detroit, The Good Place specifically has a lot of Michigan connections. You have the show's main character, Eleanor, played by Kristen Bell, who's from Metro Detroit. You have Mike Schur was born here in Ann Arbor. And you have the University of Michigan Law School making an appearance in the first season and in one of the first couple episodes. Is there some sort of magnetic attraction that brought all of these sort of Michiganders, people with roots in Michigan, together on this one show?
If there's a connection to Michigan that's cosmic, I'm not sure what it is, but it does seem as though there is some connective tissue. Mike Schur, as you say, has these roots. His father went to U of M Law School, and he was born in Ann Arbor. Kristen Bell is from Huntington Woods, right by the zoo. Mary Beth Monroe, who plays Mindy St. Clair, is from Fraser. She's from the northeast side of Detroit. I obviously lived in what we are now calling Midtown Detroit. I lived right behind the Majestic. We called it the Cass Corridor at the time. That apparently has been changed. But it really does have these interesting connective roots, and it's stuff that we talk about. I mean, it comes up on the podcast that I host for NBC, and it comes up, you know, just sitting in our chairs between takes. We talk a lot about, you know, our favorite parts of living in Detroit and which Coney Island is the best.
So which Coney Island is the best, in your opinion?
Well, it's obviously, I don't want to start a firestorm, but it's Lafayette.
So I want to talk about a project that you are involved in Detroit. You co-founded the Detroit Creativity Project, which is an improv program for kids in Detroit schools. Tell me a little bit about what you guys do.
My wife, Beth Hagenlocker, and I co-founded the Detroit Creativity Project back in 2012. In 2011, we got together with a lot of our friends out here, a lot of Detroit expatriates who live in Los Angeles, and there are hundreds of them. And we got together and said, we want to be part of the renewal in Detroit. We want to be part of the renaissance and the rebirth of this great city that we all love so much. And at the time, Mayor Dave Bing had said, you know, he would run into anybody anywhere in the world, anywhere in the country, and say, move to Detroit, bring your business to Detroit, open a business in Detroit. And so we looked for opportunities together to give back. And we hosted a number of parties at our house and just to spitball and brainstorm. And it became clear early on that the connective tissue for all of us, the common denominator and the thing that was so vital and valuable in each of our lives, was improvisation. And that's what taught us all to be so collaborative and so creative and to not fear failure and to embrace the unknown. And so we wanted to share that with a generation younger than ours. The goal of the Detroit Creativity Project has never been to create actors and comedians. If that's a side effect that takes place, that's great. But everyone in the world should improvise, whether you're, you know, in business or in medicine or a teacher yourself. Everybody should learn to embrace failure. And once you learn to improvise well, you learn to collaborate. You learn to say a lot of yes. You learn to work together and to set aside your own ego. It makes you less defensive. It makes you more curious. It makes you more confident. So we wanted to share that with students in Detroit. So the Detroit Creativity Project and our flagship program, the Improv Project, teaches improvisation in Detroit middle and high schools. And we have summer programs as well. We teach in a number of different community centers. But it's a really valuable, life-affirming, super confidence-building program that helps with interview skills for schools, interview skills for jobs, and just makes your life generally better.
And one of the interesting things about the project, too, is you've actually partnered with University of Michigan researchers to look at the social and psychological benefits of learning improv. So what do students or kids or adults get out of improv training, even if they're not going to go into a career in comedy?
We did a 2-year study with researchers from University of Michigan. And what was fascinating is that they used legitimate scientific details to have students identify their own characteristics coming in. And we learned that at the beginning of a 10-week program, lots of our students self-identified for social phobia, social anxiety, and even depression. And with class in improv 1 hour a week for 10 weeks, at the end of that, a statistically significant reduction had happened. These kids felt more confident. They felt more self-assured. They felt more confident being in front of an audience. Public speaking wasn't something that they feared as much. They didn't fear not knowing the answer. They got curious and learned how to get to the answer.
So obviously Second City Detroit is no more, but I'm wondering if you're hoping, you know, obviously not all of your students are going to go into comedy, but are you hoping that some of them maybe take up the mantle of improv in Detroit?
We do. We're very hopeful that there will be a new generation and a more diverse generation of improvisers traditionally, improvisation has been dominated by white men, and that certainly is changing in Detroit. And of course, we want Detroit to be reflected in that. We want improvisation in Detroit to look like Detroit. So we've already done it. We have alumni that have gone on to improvise in places like Ferndale at Go Comedy and at Planet Ant in Hamtramck. It was very exciting. A couple of years ago, we did a big holiday fundraiser at the DIA in the Detroit Film Theater. And some of our students from Southeastern Fairview Academy and from Hutchinson Middle School came. And we were able to tour the exhibit on a Saturday night before Christmas with some of our students and with some of the celebrities that had come in to be part of the show. And it was so exciting to have Tim Meadows and Keegan-Michael Key say to these students, middle school and high school students, wow, you guys are improvising at 14, 15, 16 years old. You have a giant head start on me. I didn't start improvising till I was 25. And to see these kids' eyes light up and saying, I have a head start on Tim Meadows. I have a head start on Keegan-Michael Key. It was really pretty wonderful to witness.
Mark Evan Jackson plays Sean on NBC's The Good Place, which is currently in its third season. He is also the founder of the Detroit Creativity Project, an improv program for students in Detroit. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been really nice talking with you. Thank you very much.
Coming up with the midterm elections tomorrow, just how has voting in Michigan changed?
It will be the first time, I think, in 127 years that straight party voting has not been on the ballot.
That is in 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio's Believed podcast explores how sports doctor Larry Nassar got away with sexually abusing women and girls he treated for so long. One of Nassar's survivors, however, was not an athlete, not a patient. She was the daughter of the Nassar family's close friends, and her story would become a turning point in the case against him. Here's a clip from this week's episode.
It's 2004. Kyle Stevens is on a long bus ride. Her sixth grade class is on its way back from a school field trip. Kyle's sitting next to one of her friends. And on the bus, Kyle's friend leans in and whispers.
She said, "What's your deepest, darkest secret?" I thought about it and I said, "I don't think I have one." And she was like, "Well, this is what happened to me."
This friend reveals that she was sexually abused by a cousin. And as she is telling Kyle more details, the gears start turning in Kyle's mind.
And I was like, well, maybe that's my deepest, darkest secret, because that's happened to me too.
You are going to hear Kyle's secret in this episode. And we want to warn you, it is a really hard story to hear, because it is about the people who love you the most and how they can fail you. But it's super important because it shows you who Larry Nassar really is and what is at stake every time he gets away. I'm Kate Wells.
And I'm Lindsay Smith. You're listening to Believed.
New episodes of Believed come out every Monday, and you can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. At last, the midterm elections are finally here. The polls open at 7 tomorrow morning. We've been hearing from the statewide and congressional candidates over these past weeks, but now let's dig into the election itself, the process, security, and GOP worries about voter fraud. Stateside held a live event at Zingerman's Gray Line last Thursday in Ann Arbor. And that's when I spoke with two guests who have a whole lot of election expertise. Chris Thomas was the director of the Michigan Bureau of Elections for 36 years. He served five administrations and four bosses from both political parties. He's now with the Bipartisan Policy Center. And Richard McClellan is a longtime election law attorney and a GOP mover and shaker. Take a listen to our conversation from last Thursday.
So, Chris, the turnout next Tuesday, the buzz is it's going to be huge. There's certainly a lot of interest. So what do you think? What are you expecting in terms of turnout?
Well, I earlier this year indicated, I think, around 4 million. So 4 million would translate into about 55, 54% of the registered voters. Now, typically, in a midterm election, we have 3.2 million, and that almost never varies. You can go back to 1998, it was 3.1, and in 2002, it was on the high side of 3.2. But then along came 2006, and that's the outlier, where we had 3.8 million. So 600,000 more voters in 2006 than in the other midterms. So now you jump to 2010, 2014, both right there at that 3.1, 3.2 turnout level and 3.2 million. So I'm expecting 4 million. And I said that several months ago based on a couple things. One was there's sort of this pent-up desire to vote. And we saw that in a primary. People came out. Typically, I wouldn't look at primaries to predict turnout for a general election. But what we saw in the primary were a huge increase of first-time voters who don't normally vote in primaries. So in Oakland County, it was like three times the number. Washtenaw County, it was seven or eight times the number. And then in certain counties like Oakland, who normally have 198,000 turnout, they had 320,000 people turn out. And a lot of them in those communities right along the border with Detroit. So I'm sensing there's a lot of millennials living in those jurisdictions. So
your Ferndales, your Hazel Parks.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And, you know, there's an open congressional seat going through there as well. So the interest is clearly evident. And, of course, we have all the statewides are termed out. So all of the statewide offices are open this November. So looking at that and sort of the national tone, if you will, and people are impatiently waiting to cast their ballots. So with that, I thought, well, we'll top 2006, which was 1.8 million, and expect to be a couple hundred thousand above that.
And Dick, from where you sit and what you're hearing, does that all square away with what you're expecting?
I accept Chris's. He's been doing this for decades. But I look at it in terms of what the likely outcome is. And I have said probably two, 3 months ago, I think it's going to be a blue wave. I think a lot of these new voters are going to be Democrats, and I think the Republicans are going to be shocked by some of the seats they lose. We've been through these wave elections, you know, over the last 30 years, and I've been through some of them. Usually, a lot of times, when we pick the wrong presidential candidate, like Barry Goldwater, Republicans were almost wiped out. So there have been other wave elections, and I think this is going to be one of those, which might be good for Gretchen Whitmer, but most of the other Republicans that I would be for, I think statewide, I don't think many are going to win. And my congressman, Mike Bishop, he's got a very strong opponent against him, and that should be a solid Republican district. You know, if it's gerrymandered the way they say it is. Now, I think you might find out after the election, there's a lot of Democrats that win in those gerrymandered districts. Mm. So we shall see. But that's where I think it will be a huge turnout. And it will tend to go blue.
You're in the right city for saying that.
So Richard never loses his
edge. He does not. So this election, no more straight ticket voting this time around. Chris, how do you expect people to react to that? Could we see more spoiled ballots and longer lines?
It will be the first time, I think, in 127 years that straight party voting has not been on the ballot. The effect of that is going to be, it's not going to be a disaster. But it's going to be perhaps longer lines. If you can avoid going first thing in the morning, do that. Go later in the day. So it's going to take a little longer for people to mark the ballot. You're going to have people questioning, where is my straight party? Because it doesn't get through to everybody that that's been gone, given the complexity of the court cases and whatnot. So for the first time through, it's going to be kind of tough, and maybe it'll be the last time through for some foreseeable future. But I think there will be an impact.
And we saw, as you referred to in the primary, with big turnout catching people flat-footed in some cases. We saw counties running out of printed ballots and looking for printers, and then we have the wrong printer, and we had emergency ballot delivery. So do you have a sense how clerks are preparing to handle this Tuesday?
Yeah, under the rules, the clerks are required to print 100%. So we've got 7.4 million voters in the state, so there'll be at least 7.4 million ballots printed. So it's very unlikely that any ballot shortages are going to come up.
Final thing on the straight ticket, how might that affect those down ballot races, let's say the State Board of Education?
Well, I guess that's what we'll see. We don't really know. So roughly 50% of the voters use straight party voting. That's pretty standard across the state. In urban areas, it's higher. Part of the pitch was when they repealed it is that straight party voting discourages people from going to the nonpartisan section and the proposal section. Now, I think that there's always going to be a fall off in the nonpartisan because people don't know who they are. They're judges, right? Oftentimes running unopposed. School board candidates will be there, so that's a new race that's been put on. But when you get to the proposal ballot, in 2012 we had five issues on the ballot. 95% of the voters voted on those issues. In 2014, we had two issues on, and 93% voted on those issues. So Michigan voters, whether they're voting straight party or mixed ticket, filling in all the ovals, they know how to get to the proposal portion of the ballot.
There has been, we're going to shift gears here, a lot of talk, starting with President Trump, right after he was elected, about, air quotes here, voter fraud. Richard, what do you want to say about this specter of voter fraud in Michigan?
Well, Michigan is different as far as I can tell. I've been on the Republican, quote, ballot integrity team. They used to get a group of lawyers to do that. The others down here in Ann Arbor, they probably call it the voter suppression team. And we would have a very significant effort to make sure the ballots were run right. We had lawyers around. We would send people out to precincts. And what I found over the years is there's almost no voter fraud that we can ever. There are mistakes that are made. You know, some of the clerks make mistakes, and a lot of times we can help fix that. So voter fraud is not a problem. I represented a former citizen of Michigan, Kwame Kilpatrick, in his recount when he won for mayor. So I thought, well, this will be interesting. If there's any fraud, it's probably committed by him in Detroit. And we really went through very carefully all of the recounted every vote. And sure, you found a few glitches here and there, but clearly was no organized fraud going on either side. It's not a problem. It's another myth that Trump keeps hammering. You know, he has his own view of the world. It's not mine.
Chris Thomas, you want to add? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah.
What do you want to add to that about the specter of voter fraud?
Well, fake views don't make real news. So, I mean, it just doesn't exist. I'm sorry. It just doesn't exist. I mean, it would be kind of cool if it did because we could all catch it and have big prosecutions and, you know, and everyone's conspiracy theories would be taken care of, but it doesn't exist. Does someone violate the law on occasion? Yes, that does happen. But these are individual acts, not concerted efforts.
So why is there so much concern and drumbeating about voter fraud, especially starting right at the top?
Well, I mean, it's a deterrent. It's a reason not to open up the system. It's a reason to basically undermine the system, and that's what it does. I mean, a lot of things that are going on today have that effect. Whether that's his intent or not, you know, I'll leave that to you all to decide. But the effect of all of this is to really undermine it for citizens out there. And it's also a great reason why you don't take any chances legislatively to have, get this, no reason absentee voting. You know, a very scary concept that 37 states have allowed people to cast a ballot before Election Day.
Let me flip to the other side of the fraud coin, then, and that is the voter suppression. And certainly we have all seen some big national headlines about questionable things being done to voter rolls in other states. And where are we in Michigan with this, Chris?
I don't find Michigan to be a big voter suppression state. My qualms with the legislature is that they just haven't gone far enough. I don't think they've gone per se out to be suppressing the vote. Our voter ID law, as it stands now, allows every person to vote. So even if you don't have an ID, you are entitled to cast that ballot. That counts that day. It's not a provisional ballot. So as long as they leave it there and they don't move to hard ID, which is in the hopper, I say okay. But when they start going to hard ID, now we start getting into the nitty-gritty of whether there's suppression. Now, suppression can show up in other ways. Now, these are not necessarily intentional suppressions. But if a jurisdiction consistently has long lines in their precincts where people are waiting over an hour and they haven't remedied that when it's been brought to their attention, well, they in fact are suppressing voters. Now, they may not get up in the morning with the intent of doing that, but the effect is just that.
Since the 2016 election, Americans have become tremendously and acutely enlightened as to the foreign interference in our election process. So bottom line, how concerned are both of you about the security of Michigan's elections and our election machines?
Well, I think you all need not be overly concerned about that. And I think our role for national security is to show up and vote. That's the key, because what this has done is another way to seriously undermine the confidence of our system is by scaring people about hacking and all of that. So we heard of all this hacking. We know it occurred. We know they went into Illinois and they actually took some records. They didn't change any records. They didn't do anything. Well, everybody's on guard right now. Everybody understands this. There's been an incredible association between the Department of Homeland Security and the Secretaries of State and Boards of Elections that has never occurred before. So there is higher security in place now than we have ever had. The Department of State here, Bureau of Elections, has contracts with cybersecurity folks working with local units of government. At the end of the day, the boxes that you see in the polling places are not connected to the internet. They're standalone boxes. And you are marking a piece of paper. And so when we do a recount, as Richard referred to, we hand count those. We don't just turn the machine back on and run them through. We actually hand count them. So the audit trail that's there is the critical piece. We are not a touchscreen state. We are a paper state. And that's the ultimate security. And there's all kinds of other steps and checks and balances that really take care of this.
Dick, you've been involved, as you say, in election law for some 50 years. You care about elections. What do you say to someone when you encounter somebody that says, I don't vote. I don't think I'm going to vote. What do you
irritating.
Say?
Irritating. you know, it is. I think we should have maximum participation. It is part of what I think is sort of a decline of general public support for what we have had is our democratic representative government system, where you go in every 2 years and you vote for a representative or a congressman or a state senator, and then they do the best they can, and if you don't like them, you throw them out. I think it's the best thing we've got. But I would rather have everybody participate, nobody be denied it. I wish the schools would teach better so the students understood the American system better. But it is somewhat troubling, the decline of voting, and I think we can only do so much with technology, with staffing, and so on. And I'm not worried about the Russians coming in and manipulating our system. The only place that I'd have any worry might be the voter information file, because it's in one computer and it's hackable. All the actual voting places are spread all over the place, and they're not connected, as far as I know. And I've done ballots in Bulgaria and in Nigeria. I've been a watcher, and so I've seen how it works in other jurisdictions. We do a pretty good job here.
Chris Thomas, longtime Michigan elections chief, and Richard McClellan, election attorney, Michigan Republican mover and shaker. It has been wonderful gleaning information from you for Election Day. Thank you for being with us on State.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.